Mark is a professor in the Department of Community Health, Urban and Public Affairs at Portland State University. He has done research on suicide rates among male Iraq veterans. A recent study by Army psychologists estimates that one-third of all soldiers returning from the Middle East suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Suicide rates among veterans and among active duty soldiers are at all-time highs. We'll hear from Mark Kaplan, and then just after noon we'll be taking your calls at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187 at approximately 12:09.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Kaplan. I'm a professor of community health at Portland State University. And I'm here to share with you work that I've done on veteran suicide. I don't have a first-person account to give you. I'm perhaps a little bit more detached of the problem, and the stories are very moving. My account is from one who has studied the trauma, the psychological trauma of war, both in the current, regarding the current conflicts, but also from a more historic perspective. The views I'm sharing with you today are views that I have shared with lawmakers and policymakers. I've been was invited to present at testimony on Capitol Hill at a Senate subcommittee, and as well as more recently, I was invited to share my views with the VA Blue Ribbon panel on the prevention of suicide that was established by was appointed by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs earlier this year, partly in response to various congressional committees. So my presentation today concerns the trauma of war, and I just want to perhaps point out it from the outset that our concerns today really date back, are ancient in nature. To some extent, we know that from accounts that have been uncovered that even back in the Trojan Wars, there was already concern about the emotional trauma of conflict. Homer in particular recounts the combat experience, and so there's written documentation that the trauma associated with war dates back many years. More recently, perhaps in the context of this country, the Civil War, as you know, there have been various excellent accounts of the trauma of war, the psychological trauma of war during the Civil War. Many soldiers experience long-term health effects from the traumatic experiences. There have been, numerous accounts, both documented in books, and we've gone back to, as part of some historic research that we've done, looked at even obituaries that appeared in the New York Times of individuals who years later took their lives. They never were able to overcome many of the physical wounds they had and took their lives, so they were traumatized by disability, if you will, some of the same issues that we face today. The other thing that started with that began with the Civil War was the introduction, wholesale introduction of firearms into the population. Various accounts of this by scholars have made it very clear that this was the beginning of the arming of this country, and perhaps the rise in individuals who completed suicide with firearms. In fact, on both sides, soldiers on both sides of the conflict after the Civil War were allowed to take home their muskets and their guns. And this really produced the situation today where we have a country that's, where we have 200 plus million firearms in the United States. More recent historic work also documents enduring nature of wartime neuroses, so to speak, variously called insanity, nostalgia, shell shock, in combat fatigue in engagements from, as I said, from the Civil War through World War I, World War II, and more recently Vietnam. World War II, excellent documentary was Ken Burns' piece that appeared on PBS about last year, I believe, where he interviewed pilots who were still traumatized, emotionally traumatized by their experience in World War II, many decades later. More recently, in regard to the Vietnam era, data from the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study showed that approximately 25 to 30% of veterans who served in Vietnam had experienced emotional trauma in the first 2 decades after service. As we know, we don't really know for sure how many Vietnam era vets died of suicide. The estimates are all over the place, and we do know that, for instance, that there's some accounts that show that there were more Vietnam-era vets who died of suicide than those who died in Vietnam. Those are huge numbers. As for Iraq and Afghanistan, the percentage of study of individuals who this is a study that was done by Charles Hogue. Who found that the he was studying the depression and PTSD among returning veterans, soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan, and he found very extensive high prevalence rates of alcohol misuse. So it's not only suicide, but other expressions of trauma. Alcohol abuse was very high after deployment. There were other expressions as well, PTSD and other problems that were reported. Back in April of this year, there was an important study, and it's available online through the RAND Corporation. It was released in April of this year, an independent study. The problem that we have today is that there are very few independent studies of the effects of war on veterans. Most of those studies have been conducted by the VA with actually most of what we know about the trauma of war in terms of more contemporary conflicts really stems from what was studied during shortly after the return of soldiers from Vietnam. So there's a lot missing in terms of our understanding of the impact, the psychological impact of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. But according to the RAND, a widely cited, widely reported RAND study released in April, nearly 20% of military service members who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, 300,000 in all, report symptoms of PTSD or major depression, rates highest among those who served in the Army and Marines. Yet only slightly more than half have sought treatment. So there's an acute shortage of treatment, accessible treatment for those who are in need. The prestigious Institute of Medicine released a report in 2000, also this year, which revealed alcohol abuse, suicide, accidental deaths in the early years after deployment, and along with marital and family conflict, also appear to be adverse results of deployment-related stress. So it's not just suicide, it's not just substance abuse, but a whole host of other problems that affect loved ones. According to the VA, Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, a report that was released earlier this year, as I think was noted early a few moments ago, according to the VA's own data, 1,000 veterans receiving care within the VA and as many as 5,000 among all veterans complete suicide every year. And that's important to note is that only about 25% of veterans seek care through the VA system. The largest share of veterans, three-quarters of all veterans in this country, seek care elsewhere, are non-users of VA for a variety of reasons. And that's an important factor in terms of how do we develop an intervention, preventive interventions. Just a couple final points. There are data from Oregon released by the Department of Human Services based on the Oregon Violent Death Reporting System showing that the rate of suicide among veterans is nearly twice that of their non-veteran counterparts. And CBS also, in their attempt to acquire data using the Freedom of Information Act over 5 months, also revealed that the risk of dying of suicide in the current cohort of veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan was also twice that of their counterparts, their civilian counterparts. Finally, I just want to mention a study that we conducted that got quite a bit of press attention. It was published in a British journal. And we also found, and this wasn't confined to, and actually didn't even include the current cohort, but we looked at veterans in general, regardless of the era of service. That is World War II, Korean era, Vietnam, and even the first Gulf War. And independent of age and independent of era of service, we found that the risk over time among veterans was twice that of their non-veteran counterparts. We only studied males, and there is some evidence now emerging that women who've served in the military, female veterans, their risk of dying of suicide is nearly twice that of their civilian counterparts. But it's an understudied, and the evidence so far is only exploratory. The data are only exploratory. I think on that note, I will end and turn things over to our next speaker. Thank you.
Not in My Name by Chumbawamba, it's a song. And this has been a whole day, actually, of testimony from the Winter Soldier Program that happened in Portland in October. And I'm Stephanie Potter, and hopefully we're going to get people calling in now to talk about their experiences and relationships to the war in Iraq and your opinion. And I'm going to give you the number right now. It's 503-231-8187. And we have some guests here in the studio with us. For the next hour and a half or so, as I said, we're going to take calls, 503-231-8187. And the three guests that I have with me in the studio are Joseph Holness, who's from Gresham. He actually testified in one of the Winter Soldier testimonies that you've heard this morning. He served 8 years in the U.S. Army in Iraq and 9 years with the U.S. Air Force Reserves, supporting Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraq Freedom. The other soldier, a friend of his who was serving with him, was over there for 7 months, his Dan Nielsen. And Dan Nielsen had been called up from the Air Force Reserve to go over to Iraq, even though he was in his 50s. And we also have a person here who's got a sense of the war from the civilian perspective. That's Muna Hamza. Muna is an internationally known journalist who has written about her Israeli-Palestinian, or about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, while living in a Palestinian refugee camp. She's an internationally known journalist because her articles have been published in the U.S., Israel, Jordan, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, and Britain. And when the Iraq invasion began in 2003, she moved from her home in Austin, Texas, to Cairo, Egypt, to work for the leading English newspaper in the Middle East, and she now lives in the Portland area. So I'd just like to welcome all of you for coming in, and thank you so much for being here. And once again, the phone number is 503-231-8187. And maybe we'll start with Joseph. Joseph, you are part of the Winter Soldier Program?
That's correct.
And you were over in Iraq, and what were some of the experiences there that sort of got you to wanting to be a Winter Soldier now?
Well, when the terms like Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, to me, they're almost an insult. Actually, they are an insult, because when we say we're going to, you know, with that word freedom, there's that sense of liberation, and yet we're over in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're an occupation army, and those people's lives that have to live there day to day, it's they're dominated, they're controlled. You know, their every little move they do, they're watched. Everything, you know, their daily activities are disrupted by, you know, American military or coalition forces activity, and it's just nonstop for them. I mean, one moment they could be going about their business, and the next thing there's a firefight or a bomb going off. Now, as far as my experiences over there, I was a convoy commander. I worked on gun trucks, and we had a gun truck platoon, and I was in charge of my platoon. And so what we did, we would escort the civilian and military convoys throughout the country of Iraq, taking supplies to the bases that were all over the country of Iraq. And then sometimes we'd go into Kuwait as well, picking up other convoys that were en route to some base in Iraq. And that was about my mission there. So we made sure that they got from point A to point B safely.
Actually, we have our first call. Lynn, Kristen? Great. Kristen, would you like to ask your question?
Hi. My name is Kristen again, and I'm a student at Oregon College of Oriental Medicine. And we are actually, as a school, wanting to set up some clinics where we can do a kind of a community-based clinic to treat using group acupuncture and ear acupuncture. Sorry, I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
To treat people that are coming back from Iraq. And we'd like to, and I'm asking actually Joe and Dan if they know of someone that we can contact, or if there's somebody listening that can be a contact for us, because we'd like to meet some veterans and give them a little questionnaire, ask them about what kind of things the clinic can do or where it can be, or what needs that people coming back from Iraq may have that we can help meet through our community clinic.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I know that I go to therapy sometimes.
Uh-huh.
On the weekend, there's a VA center on Sandy Boulevard, and the man I go see, he just recently gave me some information concerning stuff for veterans like massage, acupuncture, and the stuff that you're talking about. Unfortunately, I didn't bring that paper with me. I wish I had. That would have been great to bring up, but I didn't know we were going to be talking about that. But that's a great point. I would contact the VA center here in Portland, the one on the hill. You know where that is, correct?
I do, actually.
Yeah, I would call them and speak with them. I might be able to get a phone number for you here before, you know, the show ends, if you want to call back, and I can have that for you. That's for my counselor, and I'm sure he could hook you up.
I would greatly appreciate that. I also wanted to let people know listening, and you two gentlemen, that there is a lot of conversation happening in the alternative medicine community about how to treat people coming back from Iraq. And treat them with acupuncture, alternative medicine, chiropractic. There is currently a clinic running in Southeast Portland called the Veterans Acupuncture Project at 2828 Southeast Stevens in Portland, in Southeast Portland. And there's also a PTSD collaborative medicine lecture that's going to happen at OHSU next month, January 14th, Wednesday at 12 to 1 p.m., Richards Jones Hall, room 4340. And I really thank you two for being on the air and giving me a chance to ask for some help and let you know what our schools are doing and what we're talking about to help people coming back from Iraq.
Oh, we appreciate that. That'd be great.
Yeah, that's thanks a lot, Kristen. And once again, for listeners who'd like to call in with suggestions or your own experiences, you know, in a war zone, or just opinions that you have about all of it, please give us a call. It's 503-231-8187. And this PTSD thing that Kristen was just talking about, actually, we were just talking with Muna, who has actually been in a war zone herself, and was talking about she needs help for PTSD. And maybe you could talk a little bit, Muna, about your experiences over there.
I will, but, you know, first I want to say that it's really immensely difficult if you're
an American and you're a civilian, not a military person, and you know you don't have medical insurance of knowing where you can go to get the proper kind of treatment, I think, you know, for me in my case, it's been really detrimental, the not being able to get professional assistance. And in a way, I think, you know, with veterans, they're lucky that they have the VA and they can get treated there. So it'd be great too if civilians who've lived in war zones could be included in any treatments that might be offered in the community. My own experience with PTSD really was the result of living for 12 years from the end of 1988 till the end of 2000 under Israeli military occupation in the West Bank. And I was there living and working as a journalist. And so for 12 years, really, I was going around all the time either interviewing people who had been shot and were in the hospital. A lot of them were young people. Interviewing political prisoners who had been tortured, some of them also maybe aged 18 and 19, some of them much older than that. And so, you know, going and interviewing families whose houses had been bulldozed or bombed and they were without shelter. So, you know, at the time when I was doing all of this, I really wasn't thinking about the psychological impact that it was going to have on me. It wasn't until I left at the end of 2000 and came to the States that I started immediately, almost immediately, going through the initial symptoms of, you know, spending very lengthy hours sitting by the window, not moving out of my rocking chair, but also not realizing that I had spent 5 hours
right,
just sitting in a chair. And then, of course, the dreams, which were very consistent, just having nightmares about being shot and, you know, lots of blood and people getting wounded. And in time, these initial kinds of symptoms started subsiding, but then there were other things that I, at the time, wasn't sure that that's what they were. It really was only when I met my veteran friends here in Portland and I started reading more about PTSD that I started realizing that some of the other symptoms I have are also PTSD. For instance, things like becoming, you know, almost in a way really antisocial, even though I'm a very social person, but just, you know, creating this sense of isolation where I just would spend lengthy periods of time not leaving my house, you know, not having as many friends as I used to. If I would go to any kind of a social gathering, I would feel very isolated, almost like I wouldn't know what to talk about if it wasn't to talk about the experiences I had been through. Then the dreams. And then on top of all of that, also the sense of helplessness and guilt. I think one of the biggest disadvantages I've had with the symptoms is the immense feeling of guilt I have for having survived. Because unlike a lot of my friends who are still there, still living under occupation, I was able to get away. And so I would go through guilty feelings such as, you know, if I were to go out and spend, you know, $50 on a meal in a restaurant, immediately the next day I would feel so bad thinking I should have sent that money to my friends instead, you know. And it's just like a podium, you know, just a sentiment that keeps going back and forth and up and down, feeling guilty about any kind of fun that you have. If you travel and have a good time, you're always thinking about the people you left behind. And then the other symptom was the getting overly attached to the idea that I have to remember the name of every single person I knew who was shot dead. And for the longest time, between like 2 or 3, almost up until last year, I would just make a point. If I would forget a name, I would start crying because I just had to remember. I would feel guilty if I forgot the names. Now, because I'm so conscious of having PTSD, I'm trying to force myself to tell myself things like it's okay to forget a name. It doesn't mean that these people are not in your heart. Right. It doesn't mean that you don't care about them and that I don't have to keep remembering their names because there were just so many of them.
Right. So you're still living with this, like, you know, it's been like several years at this point, but it sounds like it's huge for you.
Yes, and I didn't really know until my friends gave me, what was the name of the book, Joseph, about Voices for Vets. When I read Voices of Vets. I just read this book last month, and at the end of it, they had some articles about post-traumatic stress, and I was really surprised to read The longer it takes for PTSD to go untreated, the worse it would get. I had thought it was just the other way around, that if I just, you know, the longer I waited, then it would go away. And, you know, to be able to, I've done it without, you know, going to therapy or being on medication. I've really tried to deal with it myself, but I could see how it's just been detrimental in so many other areas of my life. I feel like I'm not quite the person I used to be in terms of, you know, my self-confidence. I have a constant fear of loss. I don't like helicopters. I don't like the 4th of July. Anytime there's any kind of a, you know, the minutest kind of a sound that sounds like gunfire or an explosion, just the reactions that I have, I get extremely jumpy. And until now, as hard as I try, I can't break the habit of, you know, standing in the kitchen with my back to the window. I don't seem to be able to stand anywhere with my back to the window.
Right, you wanted to sit facing the door even coming in here.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, and it's just because of just this horrible fear I have of being shot in the back.
Wow. And Dan, you were talking earlier to me about how when you were over there, both of you actually were on this convoy where basically you were being bombed almost every day.
Well, it wasn't really on convoy, on the base itself, at Camp Anaconda, Balad, Iraq. You got bombed at every day of the week. There wasn't any days that you let up. If they did let up on one day, they made up for it the next day. I mean, it was an ongoing thing that never stopped.
Right. And
it was nicknamed Mortar Capital of Iraq.
Right. And by the way, I want people to be able to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. We're talking with some people who have had firsthand experience of the Iraq War and occupation and also the Palestinian occupation. And the number again, 503-231-8187. This is part of KBOO's Winter Soldier show program that we're doing pretty much all day. And so back to you, Dan. So that what was going on for you, though, how did you sort of mentally cope with this continual bombing?
Well, you didn't really mentally cope with it. Basically, what you did is just you get numb. I mean, you have no emotions to it at all. I mean, it just you walk around and there's days. You just do your job, get it done with, get over with it, go to sleep. It's a 12-hour shift. Every day of the week, you might get one day off, do your laundry, and then go back and go do whatever you do on your job.
And do you feel like that, as Muna was saying, there's some residual effects of all that from being back here again, or when you came back?
Coming back to the U.S. was completely different. I mean, you were over there to do a job, and you did the best that you could do when you get over there. And when you get back to the U.S., basically, there was nobody there to meet you at the airport. There was no place to go. It felt like the entire base abandoned you or the military. You go back to the job that you originally left, and they wouldn't give you your original job back. They gave you whatever that you think they would be able to fill in similar to it. It's just, you know, it's degrading. I mean, I went into a store and they wanted to know if I'd been to Iraq, and they kind of like looked at me like I had this glazed look in my eye, or like something was not right. And it just kind of gets to you.
Yeah. And you started to feel like the way Muna was talking about, like kind of numb from it or spaced or just, like, do you feel like you've experienced some PTSD yourself?
Yes.
Yes.
You do definitely feel like you've got PTSD. PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
You walk around and you feel like, with me, it felt like somebody was sitting on my chest because of the stress. All the stress that you get from coming back to the U.S. because you finally let your guard down, and then all of a sudden it kind of builds up into your body and it kind of like it sits there.
Right. And just this idea that it gets into your body in a lot of different ways. Joseph, you were saying that, like, for instance, you just have this medicine cabinet filled with different things, right?
Yeah, that's a sad testimony, but that's true. I'm a pharmacist's dream if you opened up our medicine cabinet. And the sad part is there's many a veteran, it's the same thing. I mean, I've seen vets and met them that are on more meds than I am, and it's a vicious cycle, because when I came home, you know, like Dan was saying, you're over there doing a mission, and you're 24/7. You can't let your guard down. You can't think about what's happening to your friends and people around you. Or, like I said, our mission was gun trucks, you know, escorting the convoys, so we were prime target of the opposition that we were against out there. We had roadside bombs, small arms fire, and RPGs, which is a rocket-propelled grenade, if nobody knows what that acronym means. And so that happened to us all the time. So you just kind of, like he says, you get numb to it. And you just, and you almost have to have a sense of humor. And I don't mean that in a morbid way. But it was how we kind of, it's like camaraderie we built up, like in my platoon. You become family, and you look out for each other. And it, basically, our mission was to get home alive.
Yeah.
But when you get home, the thing that got me was coming back to the States and seeing how oblivious, you know, John Q. Citizen is of what's really going on. And that's frustrating, because they expect you to just, like a light switch, on and off. Well, just turn off all that stuff that you were involved in and just turn on the switch and get back to normal life. Well, it doesn't work that way.
We have some more questions. I guess John Q. Citizen wants to check in with you guys. Could we get some of those? Lynn, do we have a call? Sylvia, could you ask your question, Sylvia?
Yes. First, I'd like to thank the veterans and the journalists for their service to our country and others. I'm actually a professor, and I teach sociology, social psychology, those sorts. And I wanted to ask the vets if the VA has an organized group that has some kind of support in terms of social support. For example, my current husband lost his wife fairly young, in her early 50s, and he went to a grief group. Now, I know this might sound like kind of a trivial question, but is there a support group socially built within the VA for veterans who return? And if there is not, I just want to offer encouragement and hope, because I've worked in the social service field for so many years, that please don't underestimate the power of individual camaraderie or an individual effort. Because I've been listening to this station for probably about over an hour, and so I've heard some of the testimony today, that it really, in this country, we want to depend so heavily, and as we should, and as they deserve, all of those benefits. But I'm wondering, so I guess I should ask my question again, if there is an organization for support, for socially, you know, getting together, talking about experiences that normal citizens might not understand. And two, if the veterans have considered, you know, using their life experience and hope to establish something like that to help others.
Well, there is a, I know through the VA system, once you get hooked up into it, now that's a monster in and of itself for a returning vet or even Vietnam vets, people that have not even got into the system. Once you get into the system, after the paperwork nightmare you go through, the VA does have group therapy. I was attending group therapy for PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and we had people there. Well, our group was mainly people who served in Afghanistan and Iraq. So it's, you get together, you know, you let out all the stuff that, you know, bothers you, and you talk with other veterans that have been through the same experiences you have. So, and then you have a counselor there. He's a trained counselor, or she. And so, yes, there is a program out there for veterans.
But you feel like Dan was sort of shaking his head in terms of, you feel like you, in the end, you're kind of left hanging, sort of, or?
Well, I was originally with this group, and they pretty much said that I didn't belong with them because I wasn't one of the ones who basically kind of like, as an example, bouncing off the walls.
You have to be really bad, or really bad off.
Right. We tried getting some kind of a social gathering together for us to meet and have coffee or meet and talk to each other outside of this little meeting, and it never really worked. There is not really a social gathering in the VA system.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a great idea if they did have something like that, where the people can get together, sit down, have some coffee, talk about what's going on, with without a counselor intervening with it. I mean, I try to get hold of my friend Joseph. We kind of like have gotten camaraderie together. I have him to deal with, or he's got me to deal with. I have some other people where I can get a hold of if I have a question or a problem, but to basically come up with a social gathering, not really.
And so what you created on your own. But we do have another caller. Bill, would you like to ask your question? Bill? I guess Bill vanished. Oh, Bill.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, Bill. Great. What would you like to know?
Well, I have two questions. One, I was wondering if the veterans or the VA has considered using yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong, some of these mind-body disciplines for helping the veterans. And the other question was, some people feel that there's a correlation between slaughterhouses and war, and that as long as we have the one, we'll have the other. And I was wondering what people's thoughts were on that.
How about you, Muna? What do you think?
I'm not quite sure I follow what it means, slaughterhouses.
Bill, would you like to explain that further?
Oh, about the slaughterhouses?
Yeah.
Yes.
More and more people are getting to realize that animals are sentient beings. They have emotions. They have intelligence. Not as much as humans, but they do have them. And the horrors of the factory farming and the slaughterhouse kind of make us numb to the suffering of other beings, and can unfortunately lead to us escalating our disagreements into.
Okay, so do people have a sense that maybe on a certain level our culture is getting a little bit numb to the suffering of other creatures, including animals, or? Maybe that's a little off there. Why don't we go back to the Bill's question about...
I would just like to make a quick comment about that. I mean, I could say my sense as a Palestinian-American that I've felt for quite some time now, especially with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and certainly Israel's occupation of the Palestinians, that there seems to be more compassion in the West for the lives of animals than there is for human beings in our part of the world.
The billion-dollar pet industry or something.
Yes, and you know, and we actually in the West Bank we used to have this joke always that if you're a human being then you don't have human rights. Nobody cares about your right to live even. Whereas if you're an animal, then you can have all the attention that you want. So we always say in Palestine that we wish we had in the States the. The Society for
Prevention of Cruelty
against
Humane Society.
The Humane Society, right? So we're always wishing for a humane society for human beings.
For Palestine.
Yes.
Yeah. And versus, and sometimes personally, I do think that on a certain level, we're we allow a lot of cruelty, slaughterhouses, etc. But war to me seems like the epitome of where it gets really out there.
Well, no, and I'd agree on that. I mean, there's a lot of things that desensitize people, especially when they're from this country. I mean, not to go harp on this topic about video games, but you got to look at the broad scheme of this culture here. We advocate violence. Look at the games that kids play today. Look at the television that's up there. Look at the movies. Look at listen to the music. And so, these young men and women that put on the uniform of the U.S. Armed Forces, they go over to these environments and they take that kind of mentality with them. I'm not saying that all of them are that way, but it's almost like you get this mentality of, well, I'm a superhuman and all this is like a great big video game where I really get to go, shoot somebody. And I've witnessed people like that in the military that get that mindset. And I've also witnessed the ones that before they go over, they're all gung-ho to go over there and fight and kill something. And then when they get a real taste of warfare, their attitude changes real quick.
Right. They see the suffering in it.
Yeah.
And we have another caller. Glenn, would you like to ask your question?
It's actually further to something somebody said, a place where there's coffee and you can talk and it can be, called War Stories or something. Veterans for Peace, Chapter 72, has some kind of relationship with the Red and Black Cafe. And that sounds like kind of what you were talking about. You'll have to go to Veterans for Peace to find out the details.
Okay, that sounds good.
Sure, thank you.
Have you guys heard of that? Veterans for Peace, Chapter 72?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's one more thing to throw out there. And so we were kind of talking again, though, just about your experiences. And I think that one of the things, maybe going back to Bill's question a little bit, is what sort of happens over there, and maybe you were seeing it, Dan and Joe, about a kind of a dehumanization, and it sounds for sure that Muna was seeing it, that the enemy has to be kind of dehumanized for you to sort of actually function over there?
Well, I saw that and how, I mean, there was two things you see here. Well, we're over, our commanders will tell us we're here to liberate the Iraqi people, and yet I saw it witnessed firsthand are how we liberated people. I mean, I've witnessed field interrogations that were pretty bad. These people's lives are just disrupted on a daily basis. You know, there's no respect, no dignity, nothing towards these people from, you know, many of our people in uniform over there. And I'm not saying that everybody in uniform is that way. That's not true. I mean, a lot of people, men and women over there, I mean, they joined the military. They had no idea this war was going to happen. And, you know, they go do their job. You know, right or wrong, they go do their job. But, no, I mean, to me, that's the thing that got me upset all the time. Every time we go hit the road and do on these convoys was, you know, we're preaching Iraqi freedom and Pax Americana across the world, and yet what about these nations like Sudan? We'll use that as an example, where genocide is going on. How come we're not down there liberating those people? And, you know, you think about these things, like, what are we here to liberate? Are we here to liberate people? Are we here to liberate oil fields? So.
Right. That's it. And okay, one more. We're going to take calls from listeners. The number here is KBU Radio 503-231-8187. If anybody'd like to call in and comment on the whole winter program, Winter Soldier program that we're doing. And so, when you actually saw these interrogations, Joseph, what did you actually see? I mean, what was going on with them?
Well, what they do is, you know, in a convoy, you're on the road, and of course sometimes they'll come across, there'll be an incident on the road that happened, like a roadside bomb went off, a truck got hit, or maybe somebody up ahead has noticed found a roadside bomb and they stopped the convoy. Well, what happens a lot of times is if there's traffic, like the locals there coming and going, sometimes I've seen, you know, our troops pull people out of cars, and this one family in particular, it was a mother, father, and their kids, and I assume, the mother of one of the
parents.
One of the parents there. And a lot of people in Iraq carry small arms, like AK-47s or pistols or whatever. That's normal. That doesn't mean they're a combatant, but people have them. And so this guy had a pistol when they stopped his van, and this was happening in front of us, and they frisked him, and they got a pistol, and then had everybody get out of the van. And so they automatically assume this guy was, an insurgent. So they put duct tape around his, mouth, right, and handcuffed him in front of his family. They're seeing this. And then they took him out of vision to where they could see, but we could see it, and they started working him over. I don't know what they were asking him. I couldn't hear it, but I know they worked him over pretty good.
Right, and he didn't end up loving America after that.
No.
Right. And you were seeing a lot of sort of kind of racism, dehumanization in the whole Palestinian situation, Muna, right? I mean, things like that were going on there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, on a daily basis, it's... I personally think it's just part of, occupation policy. But, sometimes it would be things as simple as, an 80-year-old man getting on a bus in Bethlehem wanting to go to Jerusalem to pray in the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. And, you'd have an 18-year-old soldier with a gun, get on the bus and push him off the bus because he didn't have a permit to go, from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. Just the way people would get treated and pushed. A lot of times when I worked at a newspaper in Jerusalem and I would, at the end of the day, take the bus back to Bethlehem, I would see lined up next to the checkpoint along the side of the road, there would be sometimes, 10 guys, sometimes maybe 20 Palestinian guys who had been stopped by the Israeli soldiers, and for one reason or another, they wouldn't let them through, and what they would do is they would just let them kneel on the ground all day long. Mm-hmm. Basically, they would catch them early in the morning, and especially in the middle of the summer when it's really hot, and they would force them to pull their T-shirts up above their heads and sit with their backs facing the sun. And so I remember many times, like at 4 in the afternoon, you know, on a hot summer day in Jerusalem, I'd get on the bus to go back home after a long day at work, and you would see that. You would see all of these men of different ages, you know, anywhere from 18 to 65, lined up against the road. And, of course, all day long, they've not been able to go to the bathroom or have a drink of water or anything to eat. Most of them work as laborers or painters or bricklayers, and, you know, they would try to get across the checkpoint or bypass the checkpoint to go work so they could feed their families. And I think for me, you know, because I was there not just as a Palestinian, but I was also American, and the comparisons that I was doing all the time of here, how you easily just pick up the phone and call 911 if your neighbor's dog pooped on your lawn and they wouldn't pick it up. And mm-hmm. over there, you know, you have all of this humiliation that's going on. And I always felt so frustrated as an American specifically,
right.
that there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get off the bus and tell the soldiers they had no right to do this. I couldn't do anything. You watch it, you swallow it, and then, you know, you go home to then have the soldiers storm into your house. I mean, I've had that happen to me a lot of times where I had, you know, the gun, machine guns, you know, in my chest, and the soldiers threatening to beat up my ex-husband. You know, so you're put in these terrifying situations, and then just the immense helplessness that you would feel when you would see, you know, six soldiers beating up on a 12-year-old kid. And a lot of times I tried. The women over there were extremely courageous. The moment that they would hear a kid screaming in the street, they would just all run out. And they didn't care that the soldiers were armed. They would just basically start attacking the soldiers with the intent of getting them to get off the children. And I remember the first time that I ran outside with everybody else, you know, to go to this child's rescue, I was really ashamed of myself because somehow, as I was running halfway, I just stopped. I could just feel the numbness, and I just had such horrible pain in my knees. I couldn't move. I was so afraid. And I think maybe in my case it was because the result of going into so many homes to interview the families of people who had been shot dead. And so I knew just from experience that really bullets, you don't think twice about it. The bullet isn't going to be thinking, oh, no, I'm not going to hit this person's head. If you're hit, you're dead. There's no question about it. And so I just developed this intense fear of you know, the guns and bullets and the bombings. And so I realized that day that even though I could see the child in front of me and I wanted so much to help like everybody else, I wanted to have their courage, I just froze in my place.
You're straight out frightened.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Understandable. And anyway, the phone number to call here for the KBOO Winter Soldier Program is 503-231-8187. Yeah, and we're going to play actually a song right now. It's called Support the Troops by Country Joe McDonald.
Beat the drum, wave the flag for those who won't be coming back. Numbers rise and build another wall for those who answered the country's call. The troops, support the troops. Gold Star mothers, Gold Star dads, left with nothing but a folded flag. Gold Star brothers, sisters too, feel their pain. It could be you. Support the troops. Support the troops.
Hi, we're back. This is KBOO Radio. I'm Stephanie Potter, and we have three people who have experienced war firsthand. As part of our Winter Soldier program, I have Joseph Holness here with me, who was in the Iraqi Freedom thing, and he was there with Dan Nielsen, and they're both part of the Air Force. And we also have Muna Hamza, who's was actually in Palestinian refugee camps as an American journalist over there, sort of exploring what was going on over there, and ended up doing a lot of suffering herself. And we are taking calls from listeners. If people want to call in and let us know what you're thinking, or if you have any opinions or any ideas or support or whatever, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. And I think another issue that comes down with all this is that soldiers are over there, and you signed up. Actually, you were a career soldier, right, Joseph?
Yes.
Yeah. And yet you've sort of become quite the opposition soldier at this point.
Yes. Well, like I say, I initially signed up. I was going to make a career out of it. I do believe a military needs to be in a nation, but on a defensive purposes. Going into other countries unprovoked, and a lot of people argue this point, I still say that going into Iraq was an unprovoked act, period. And this outgoing regime was doing everything it could to start a fight over there, and they did. I mean, they kept on pulling rabbits out of hats. You know, first it was the weapons of mass destruction, and nothing was found, and then the next thing was, well, if Saddam, you and your sons need to step down for power, or we're coming in. And that's basically the excuse they finally settled with.
Right.
And to me, it was like, this is nonsense. Here we are supposed to be the most powerful nation and influential nation in the world, and we're looking like a bunch of bullies and blackmailers. And that's essentially what we did with Iraq. We blackmailed Iraq so we could march right on in. And under the guise of, we're liberating you from Saddam and all your, you know, miseries and problems. Well, there's all kinds of miseries and problems there right now. I'm not saying Saddam was a great man. He wasn't. But the bottom line is, you know, my honest opinion, in another nation, there's a sovereign nation. It's up to the people there in that nation to decide what they're going to do with their leadership. It's not up to us.
And, okay, you had something, Muna?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that one of the hardest thing for me is, as an American, was and still is, to see the images of our soldiers in Iraq, and it's very hard for me not to think of them as Israeli soldiers, because when you see the images on TV, especially what Al Jazeera broadcasts live from Iraq, you see soldiers kicking in people's homes and going in at gunpoint to search, and then just the way, you know, a house is left in a mess because they've gone through all their stuff. It's exactly the same way that, you know, Israeli soldiers act in the Palestinian territories. And I never thought I would live to see the day when, you know, our boys would give off that same impression in the Middle East. But in the Middle East, that's what people are seeing when they look at TV. There now seems to be no difference between an American soldier and an Israeli soldier.
Right.
So it's how to change all of that.
How to change all of it. And again, the phone number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187. If people have any comments or questions or things they'd like to add to the discussion about the Winter Soldier program, which actually took place back in October, and it's soldiers who are trying to basically change the narrative of war and get us out of Iraq. And I think one of the things that you'll hear from people who are into being soldiers is, well, you knew what you were getting into. You signed up for it. You signed that contract. Or it's your duty to protect the country, or, you know, sort of different issues like that. But I think also on a certain level, sometimes soldiers feel that for instance, like there's this what we call the backdoor draft, that actually the Army is not playing fair with people who did sign their contracts. Do you guys have some comments on that?
You want to take that one? Go for it.
Okay. I can tell you what happened with us. We were originally Air Force Reserve, and they requested five guys to go to get deployed over to Iraq as a convoy driver. We get over there, and we have no clue what we were supposed to be doing. We're not trained for what we were doing. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. They ended up doing going from a driver to a convoy escort gun trucks. The training that we got was like a week's worth of training compared to what normally the Army would get, about a year's worth of training.
Wow. That's incredible. Right, and you were just sent over there with this, okay.
That's just one example. The other one is that the Army was running out of so many people that they had no clue on what to do with us. They needed people so bad that they pretty much, okay, we need them now, ship them over there, we'll get the training when they get over there. It's also another way of calling in as the backdoor draft. We were pretty much drafted into the Army for a year to do whatever they wanted us to do. I mean, the Air Force isn't really a major combatant into working for the Army. We're never trained to do that. We might be able to shoot a gun once every 3 years because that's all we need to do to qualify with the M16.
So basically what you're talking about is that the rules of engagement were constantly being changed on you.
That was a daily experience, the rules of engagement. Give an example. There was a group over there, I don't remember who they were, but it was a militant organization, they wore black outfits and green armbands. And we were told to shoot those people on sight. Well, the problem with that is there's a lot of people that wear, you know, black robes. A lot of the women there do. And, you know, you have these people that you tell, you shoot them on sight, especially some young kid. Oh, there's somebody in a black outfit. Pow!
Wow.
And, I mean, they're not looking for the green armband. Well, you know, after a while, it doesn't take too long before people realize, hey, you know, whoever this group was, they're going to blend in with the locals. So, to me, that was just an example. Like, another time was on the convoys, we were told to shoot people that threw rocks. I mean, literally shoot them dead. Then the next thing we're told is to fire warning shots in the air. And then the next thing we're told is don't do anything unless you're fired upon. Don't, shoot the rock throwers. And it was back and forth constantly.
Right. So you kind of really never even knew what you were supposed to do over there.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, our thing, like I said before, we got to the point where we were like, we depended on each other. I know in my platoon, we were like a family. And basically we just got to the point is, well, we're going to do what we need to do to make it home alive.
Right.
And that didn't mean go, you know, run roughshod over the countryside, but we knew our command over there, they didn't know what the heck was going on, and they were just throwing stuff out to make themselves look good. And, you know, we're the ones having to go out there and do this job. And it was very frustrating.
Right.
Very frustrating.
Right. Once again, the phone number to call into KBOO is 503-231-8187 if you'd like to call in and share your comments or concerns about our role in Iraq and what's going on for the soldiers there. And but back to this backdoor draft again, there is a sense that you get pulled in sort of and then stuck, like the stop-loss deployment. Did you experience that at all yourself, or were you talking to other people who are going through that?
There were people that I knew that experienced the stop loss. I have friends that were serving in the Army that were involved in stop loss. And the Air Force wasn't the only one they were doing this to. They were doing it to the Navy as well. We have people that were Navy, you know, petroleum specialists and CVs and stuff like that that were out there doing these running convoys. And they're like looking at everybody, we didn't train to do this. And the Army would just pull anybody they could get,
right,
throwing them in a truck, throwing a weapon in their hands, say, you know, okay, you're going to do convoys.
Right. And so was your experience in that it sounds chaotic.
It is.
And that mistakes were being made on a certain level because of this sort of chaos and lack of training and things like that.
Well, sometimes there'd be a confusion as to where you needed to be, and sometimes the convoy could get lost or go down a wrong path.
Right.
And then, you know, or you get to a base, and where are you supposed to take all this equipment to? And then you're waiting for the next group so you could escort them back to our base. And the worst one we had were the fuel trucks. Fuel trucks were the worst because we'd go up and get those. They were coming in out of Turkey. And we didn't like those, you know, escorting tanker trucks because a tanker truck takes a hit, it's going to go up big, and it's going to take everything around it.
Right.
And so, half the time, the people driving those trucks, they were Turkish, and they didn't understand English. They couldn't understand us. And so anytime the convoy would stop, they'd take off out across the field or something. I don't know what they were doing, but or there was a hit on the convoy, then they'd take off running. And you're having to round up these people to get them back into the trucks because you don't want this great big fuel truck sitting out there. And I've seen those things go up, and it's a mess.
Right.
So.
And you had some comments too, Dan, about this?
Well, my comment wasn't about the convoys. Mine was more on the lines of the rules of engagement.
Uh-huh.
Rules
changing.
The changing of the rules of engagement. There was a situation over there where at one time you had to show an ingression to an oncoming vehicle that was getting too close to you. I mean, then they changed it to the point where you cannot show any aggression until they show an aggression towards you.
Why do you think that was changing? Why were they making these rules change all the time?
I think it was all this political correctness going on back. I mean, you had people, you had commanders over there that were looking for brownie points. I mean, I'm just going to be honest with you. And they were trying. The sad part, it's a vicious cycle. You know, you get into combat, there's no such thing as political correctness. And I'm not saying that gives you a license to go just destroy everything in your path, but warfare is warfare, and it's ugly.
Right.
And you had people in there, and that was the confusing part. You'd have commanders over there that, you know, want you, you know, gung-ho, all that, and then you get the other ones that, you know, just totally opposite. And then you have people back here in the States. You know, we'll give an example. In Afghanistan, there was a city bombed, which we flew through, or I'm not saying us personally, but the U.S. military flew through and bombed it. Well, then they flew in afterwards and dropped MREs, which are meals ready to eat. They're, you know, it's what we eat in the field as soldiers, like dropping them on these villages. Here they've blown these people to oblivion, and then they drop these things like, oh, we're sorry, we didn't, you know, we're sorry we bombed your village. We had to get the bad guy.
Right.
And they're dropping this food like it's going to make it okay.
Right.
I mean, see the foolishness in that.
Right. In other words, just back and forth, and it seems
exactly.
Like,
and to me,
yeah,
as a citizen of those countries, I'd be pretty pissed off. And that's the thing people don't realize is this war, there's generations of people that lost family members, that lost their livelihood, or got themselves messed up pretty bad, and they're going to grow up remembering America and all this bit, and it's not going to be a pleasant deal.
Right.
This is not going to heal right away.
Right, exactly. Well, and if people want to call in and comment on this, the phone number again is 503-231-8187. And Lynn, do we have another caller? Aaron, would you like to ask your question?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Aaron Clance. I was the co-author of the Winter Soldier book with Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Great.
So, Jenka Soderberg, your news director, suggested that I take part in today's conversation.
Okay. So, and basically you authored the book, huh? And you were a part of sort of creating the whole organization.
Well, I'm a reporter, so it was my job when these courageous veterans came together in Silver Spring, Maryland for the first time in March of this year to help edit their testimony into a book that would preserve it. And it's such a great honor and a privilege to see that this movement that started in Silver Spring in March of 2008 is spreading all over the country, including to the Portland area.
Right, and it's definitely, it was a very successful program, I believe, here in October when we had a lot of people. And so as a reporter, what was your basic sense of the whole thing in terms of how the people were responding to it and what you were learning from it?
Well, I mean, I had been in Iraq myself from 2003 to 2005. I had previously written a book called How America Lost Iraq. And when I heard that these veterans were going to come forward en masse together and share their stories and talk about what they had actually seen and done in Iraq, I thought it was incredibly important that it be written down and memorialized in a book so that book could be shared around the country, and so that it could help give birth to successor events like the one that you guys had in Oregon recently. There's been other Winter Soldier events around the country, in Seattle, in Illinois, in Tampa. You know, you name it, the cities are having them. Soldiers are coming forward and talking about what they saw and did. And it's a tremendous tribute to KABU that you are being part of making that historical record.
And how do we get the book? It's just for sale right now, or it's all over?
Yeah, absolutely. So people can go to, to Amazon. They can go to the website of Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org, and buy it from there. They can go to local bookstores and buy it. The publisher is Haymarket Books. If you, go to the website of Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org, and you buy it from there, then all proceeds from the sale of the book will go directly to the veterans themselves.
Great. And one thing that really interests me about the whole Winter Soldier thing, it seems like there's, as I sort of said in the beginning, there's two issues that are going on with it. One is just to get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. The other one is to change the narrative of war. And, first of all, we have one narrative of war that sort of comes across, I think, kind of idealistic and all of that. And how do you see the narrative now yourself, and then how would you like to see it change?
Well, I mean, I think that the veterans know what war is about. War is about people killing each other. I saw that firsthand as a journalist. These soldiers participated in it. It is such an important and incredible thing for somebody to step forward, as these veterans have done, and say, I did that. That was me. I pulled the trigger. It helps verify the stories of the Iraqi civilians who are coming forward and saying, the American forces came through, they raided my house, they took away all the men, they disappeared into Abu Ghraib, they were tortured. When I was over in Iraq filing stories, people would often ask me, well, where's your corroboration? Well, here's the corroboration. These veterans are providing the corroboration. They are saying, you know, this is what the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan are all about, and it's not very pleasant.
It's not noble.
It's also not very easy for them to do.
Right.
It's not easy to come forward and say, you know, I killed an innocent pregnant woman at a checkpoint. That's not an easy thing to do. It's much easier to come home and have people say that you're a hero and then try to forget about it forever and ever, which is what most people go through. But these veterans in Iraq, Veterans Against the War, these Winter Soldiers, are trying to turn the tables on that and say the way to honor our service is to not forget what we did.
Right. And then actually, because they come home, because they're a lot of the ones probably that do have heavy duty PTSD and stuff are sort of like, because they are sort of trying to say, well, we did a good thing over there, and there's something niggling at their conscience that's making it very difficult to do that.
And the thing that makes these Winter Soldier gatherings possible is that you get all the veterans together in one room, and they're able to support each other.
Right.
It's very difficult. I mean, even me as a reporter, it was very difficult for me to come home and tell my friends and my family what I had really seen over there. Now, you just imagine if you're the one who pulled the trigger, that puts you in an even more difficult situation. You don't want to look your mother in the eye or your sister in the eye or your husband or wife in the eye or your children in the eye and tell them these things. It's very, very difficult. But at Winter Soldier, the veterans were able to gather around them, you know, hundreds of other vets, so that when they went up and they told their stories, they were able to do it free from judgment and with support of those around them.
Right.
And that's so important. That's why another reason I thought it was important for the book to come out, and why, you know, I hope that people go and buy it, and especially if you have a service member in your family who has come home recently, because it's very easy to feel alone.
Right.
And this Winter Soldier movement, the book, I know there's going to be a film that's going to be coming out. It's a way to say to people, you are not alone in the guilt that you are experiencing after coming home from your service. You are not the only person who experienced these things in Iraq and are reacting to it in this way. There are many, many other people in this country just like you, and here are their stories.
That's beautiful. And we have another caller on the line. Scott, would you like to ask your question?
Yeah, are your guests still there?
Yeah, including the phone call fellow.
Yes, the recent book by Vincent Bugliosi about the trial for President Bush for murder. What do you think about a subsegment of the vets, especially the veterans and their families who may have lost soldiers in Iraq, actually after the inauguration of President Obama, working as suggested, as Vincent Bugliosi suggested, with the attorney generals of the 50 states and the hundreds of district attorneys of the counties in which soldiers have died, to actually try to get a grand jury, talk to those prosecutors and those AGs, to convene grand juries to have charges against Condoleezza Rice, the vice president and president, for crimes such as conspiracy to commit murder, which was suggested in the book. And then lastly, it was offered by Vincent Bugliosi that he would give a free legal team, including himself, to help any prosecutor in the United States that is the first to file charges. I'd like to hear what your guests have to say.
I'm all for it. I think this whole regime and all its corporate benefactors should be brought up on charges, and some of them for war crimes. That's me personally. It just makes me sick to see these people jumping ship, you know, since the outgoing regime. You know, I mean, Obama's going to be, you know, taken over in the White House here in January. And I see on the news how all these pardons are happening for all these different people that had a part in all this war and the profiteering off of it and the bad information that they knew they were getting. Like, you know, Condoleezza Rice got on, you know, she was on the news the other day going on about, well, you know, we acted on poor intelligence information that we got. And it's like, didn't you know this from the get-go? I mean,
right.
I find it hard to believe these people with their education and experience, you know, didn't know any better, which to me is they knew it. They knew better. They did know better, and they went ahead with it. It was a way for them to come out of this sitting high and dry on their, you know, piles of profit that they made off of this conflict, both conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right. And the fellow on the telephone again, the Winter Soldier, what was your name again?
Oh, Aaron Glenn.
Aaron Glenn, sorry. Okay. Do you have a comment on that?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that there has not yet been an accounting of responsibility, and hopefully we'll get that in the future for the things that have been done in the new administration.
And how about you, Muna? Do you have any comments on that?
Oh, I definitely agree. I keep wishing for the day when we're going to see George W. squirming in court, you know, testifying, because I think, you know, it's not just an issue of the soldiers who were killed or the Iraqis who were killed. It's the people who survived, people who were maimed for life.
Right.
We have thousands of soldiers who have handicaps that are going to be with them for life, and it's the same with the Iraqi people. And, you know, I think if they don't pay the price, and if they're not, you know, put on trial as war criminals, then nobody's going to get any sense that justice had been done.
Right, right. And how about you, Dan?
Well, my opinion is that Condoleezza Rice herself is kind of like she's a puppet. She's told what needs to be done, where it needs to be done, how it needs to be done, and pretty much is her hands is really tied. I don't think that she is the big problem. I think it's coming more from higher ups. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at it on the news, she pretty much is like, she stands there and she's like has a blank face. And she just looks like she's answering the questions.
Right.
Yes, but Dan, sorry. You know, I mean, in the end, each and every one of us has the responsibility to act morally or immorally. It's a personal choice. So to say that she's not in any way responsible, she could have resigned a very long time ago if she wasn't pleased with the policy of the president.
And I think that's actually, even in the end, what the Winter Soldiers are all about, is trying to get it out that we did something and we did something wrong and we want to change that.
And the one important thing to add to that is we continue to do it.
Right.
Yes, you know, I mean, and so we cannot only focus on holding the Bush people accountable for starting this war. We have to remember that this war is actually still going on, and those of us who have friends and family who are over there in Iraq right now know this very deeply. And one of our jobs that I'm so grateful for KBOO for this program is that the coverage of the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan in the mainstream media has collapsed.
Yes.
In the last month, only 2% of news stories have been about Iraq and Afghanistan. So you don't hear stories about innocent people being shot at checkpoints, and you don't hear stories about the 300,000 American veterans who have come home and filed disability claims with the federal government. You don't hear stories about casualties on either side in the media. And we need to make sure that these issues stay front and center in the next period, or else this war is just going to continue.
Right. And if callers want to call in, the phone number here at KBOO, we're going to take calls for maybe 15 more minutes, is 503-231-8187. We have three guests here who are part of the two guests who are part of the soldiers, Joseph Holness and Dan Nielsen, and a civilian perspective, which is Muna Hamza. And on the phone now, we have Aaron Glantz, who wrote a book called The War Comes Home, who helped to actually galvanize this whole Winter Soldier program to start changing the narrative around war. And it's a really important thing that we have to be dealing with now. And so basically then what we're talking about is the media at this point. And I know, Muna, you have a lot to say about how the media should be doing its job, right? Like, you have notions about that.
Well, I watch Al Jazeera Arabic channel on TV at home, and it's really interesting to watch the difference between coverage that you see on Al Jazeera compared to Good Morning America. There is no comparison. I know Al Jazeera has been accused of a lot of airing a lot of propaganda. I don't agree with that at all. What Al Jazeera does is the cameras are there. They're showing you what is happening on the ground, not just in Iraq, but in Afghanistan. And there's most importantly, they're showing you the human suffering, which seems to get sidetracked in this war. Nobody's really talking about the human suffering. Not only do you have people who've been killed, you have so many millions of Iraqis who've become homeless and are living outside of their country right now. There are those who are internally displaced. Plus, like I said, there are those who have been injured and will be maimed for life. Plus all of the psychological damage of what happens to people when they live through war. So I studied journalism in college. It's
right.
One of my biggest regrets. because I've just been so disappointed by mainstream media. And one of my wishes of the things when people say, okay, well, so what can we do? What can we as average Americans do? Well, I would like to see people picketing in front of the local TV stations and in front of the Oregonian to demand more even-handed coverage so that people are exposed to the truth. And I am convinced, absolutely convinced, from the images that I do see on Al Jazeera, that if your average American citizen were to watch these same images, they will not stand for it. They will not stand for it at all.
We have another caller on the line. Merrily?
Hey there. Yeah. I heard Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! This morning talking about Germany might be able to kick the United States military out of Germany. The Germans don't like it. And they don't like being used to stage an aggressive war. And they might be able to arrest, say, Rumsfeld if he comes to Germany.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And I've heard actually that Rumsfeld is wanted in some country. I can't remember where it was now. But East Germany, yeah. Or east where? Okay. But
yeah,
anyway...
Germany, yeah.
Germany. So, and I know that we do have something like 700 bases or even more all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and...
Crazy.
What's that?
That's crazy.
I know. I agree.
What's that all about?
And the costs of this. I think that's something we haven't really gone into. We're going into the human suffering and the human costs, but there's also... tremendous just monetary costs with this this occupation and having bases. And basically, I think if we wanted to admit it, we might call ourselves an empire. But do any of you have any comment on that?
Well, I'd agree. You know, it's kind of, we like to shake our finger at other countries around the world for things they do and accuse them of the very same things that we do. Give an example, this latest thing that happened with Georgia, between the nation of Georgia and Russia. Well, we had to get involved in that. We had to go over there, and we're shaking our finger, Russia, you're bad for doing what you did. So we start sending aid to Georgia. We start sending U.S. naval ships into the area, not to mention this defensive missile complex thing that's going to be put in Poland. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Mm.
And that's been a very big political issue with Russia and the United States. Well, and then we're getting mad because Russia is sending like naval ships and aircraft to do training missions with the Venezuelans. And we're like, you know, why are you doing this? You know, people are getting uptight about that. And it's like, well, what do you think we're doing there? We're right on Russia's, you know, front doorstep with this stuff, trying to tell them what to do and, you know, we're kind of flexing our muscles over there at them, and then we get all upset when they come over here into the Caribbean, and, of course, this is with another country, of course, Venezuela. And it just amazes me how we like to point our fingers at everybody else. You can't do that. Do as I say, not as I do.
Right.
So, yeah, it's empire.
Right. And because of that, there's a lot of suffering here at home. Muna, you were looking at some numbers on what it's actually costing.
Total cost. And, you know, you think that there are so many Oregonians who are unemployed now. There's so many Oregonians who don't have medical insurance. And, you know, and even if we're going to be spending that money in Iraq, why aren't we spending it to build a real infrastructure for the Iraqi people? I mean, I've always believed, having lived, you know, I mean, first time I lived through war, I was 8 years old, and I've lived through wars all of my life. And it seems to me that we need to have a total change in our thinking in terms of our foreign policy, because to bring about the desired change in the Middle East, it seems that it's the people's hearts and minds that we need to gain. And you're not going to gain the hearts and minds of, you know, young Palestinians or Iraqis or Afghanis if you are going to bomb them. I used to see this a lot in the West Bank. There would be an area that was shelled by the Israelis. We would go in as journalists to report about it, and you would have all of these little kids running up to you with the remnants of the bombs, sticking them in your face and saying, America, America. Mm-hmm. And I used to collect them. I would look at them, and it would say, for the tank shells, it said that they were made in Mesa, Arizona. It just said right there on them, made in Mesa, Arizona. And the tear gas canisters were made in Pennsylvania. So if we are not going in as Americans, and if we really believe in this country, if we really believe in liberty and freedom and democracy, truly believe in it, and we really want to export it to the rest of the world, I think it's possible. There are nonviolent means to resolve conflicts, and we can go in and we can build hospitals. There's an unbelievable number of cancer cases throughout the Middle East, particularly in like Iraq and Jordan and Palestine. So if we're going in and we're building schools and we're building hospitals and we're exporting our know-how to these countries, then we will gain the affection and the love of the people. But
right.
Instead, what we're doing is, not only are we at war there, but in other countries, for instance, like Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel. And Egypt has had the same president since 1979, and it's very much a police state. It's the kind of place, if you're Egyptian and you're a journalist and you write the wrong thing about the government, you will disappear, and journalists have disappeared. And yet, we support it because it's our puppet, and the Egyptian regime will do whatever we want. So unless Americans start paying attention and start asking questions and demanding change, change isn't going to happen. And I'm afraid... Personally, I think if we do send more troops to Afghanistan and everything that's been happening now in Pakistan and India as well, I'm not optimistic about where things are going.
Yeah, it's definitely getting more and more and more volatile and scary
yes.
over there.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And is Aaron still on the phone?
Yes.
Great. Do you have any sort of more media comments about this?
Well, you know, one thing that Luna mentioned was the cost of this war, and she said it was about $600 billion, and unfortunately that's only part of the cost of the war, because when we think about the cost of the war, we have to think about all the costs. And she's mentioning the amount of money that we spent, that Congress has appropriated to spend on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's a lot of money, but then you have to add in all the amount of money that we're spending on disability claims
right.
for the 300,000 veterans who have come home. You have to add in all the amount of money that we're spending on health care for all the veterans who have come home. You have to add in all the money that we're spending on Humvees and tanks to replace the Humvees and tanks that get blown up in Iraq. None of these things are counted in that $600 billion figure. And the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz has done an analysis showing that the war, if it were to end in the next year, would cost us $3 trillion.
Wow.
Which is, you know, more than three times the amount of money that we just threw down the toilet to the banks.
Right.
And that number is only going to climb again if the war does not end. And I feel like the most important thing about Winter Soldier and Iraq Veterans Against the Wars is a constant reminder that the war is still happening, the war is still around, that the war did not go away just because the stock market collapsed, and that every day people continue to die.
Right. I mean, there was just a bunch of that again today, I think. And people are dying in Baghdad regularly. And actually, we're getting out of time here, but I would just like to say, does anybody have any comments, including you, Aaron, that you'd like to sort of help finish this up with, this first part of our segment here?
Well, I mean, I'd just like to, again, thank KBOO for making the time, so much time today, to talk about the reality of a U.S. foreign occupation. I'd like to thank the veterans for coming forward and sharing their stories.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to say real quick, I know there's people out there that probably view us as traitors and all the rest. Well, you can think what you think. We support the troops. We're not against the troops. It's troops like us getting together and standing up and as one voice and saying this is wrong. We are for the troops.
Right.
My opinion, as I've been trying to say, is that if you want to really watch the news of getting the actual news of what's going on around the world, listen to either the BBC or the Canadian Broadcast Company. They're pretty much not as censored as the news in the U.S.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. And then, of course, Muna likes Al Jazeera.
Yes, I do. I'd love to work for Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
Report the truth.
Right.
Uncensored. My wish is that the American public will start paying closer attention to foreign aid and support of oppressive regimes, particularly in the Middle East. And I do think that the more people who come together, the more power we will have to make change. And again, the idea isn't to be anti-American or to speak ill of the United States. It's how do we reach a stage to where, we can bring about peace without war.
Right.
And there are ways to do that.
Right. And so instead of munitions makers making big profits, we start supporting people all over this planet.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to finish off again, the whole Winter Soldier program, we're going to take more testimony, actually, or be listening to more testimony in the next half hour or so. But I have with me here again, as I said, I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm with Joseph Holness, Dan Nielsen, both of them served in Iraq, and Muna Hamza, who is a journalist who was in a Palestinian refugee camp. And all of them have known up close and personal the suffering caused by war. And real quick, just to read, Winter Soldier was, and then Aaron Glantz, and you're still there, and your book, The War Comes Home, which is basically to let people know about the whole Winter Soldier program and to get us out of there, get us out of these wars and back to being sort of sane, sensible people that care about each other. And I'll sign off right now, okay?
We now return to the Winter Soldier event held in Portland in October of this year. We will again take your calls beginning at 2:15 at 503-231-8187. Coming up next, the voices of Iraqi Americans and Iraqi civilians. We begin with veteran Iraqi journalist Dar Jamal.
Hi, everybody. My name's Dar Jamal. I worked in Iraq between 2003 and 2005 for a total of 8 months over 4 trips as a journalist, and have continued to cover the Middle East since then, and we'll be going back soon. I'm going to just share a few stories about some of the things I witnessed about the toll being taken on the civilian population in Iraq during my time there. And I'm going to start with a story. Well, let me preface all of this with, first of all, thanking everyone for coming and sitting through these panels, the previous panel, and this one. It's extremely difficult information to hear about and to share, but like Camilo said at the end of the first panel, this has to happen, and this information has to get out, and then it's up to you to help us continue to get this information out. One of the first stories I came across when I got into Iraq, and this was in November of 2003, so pretty early on in the occupation, we got word about a very bad incident that happened in Ramadi. And so myself and a couple of other foreign journalists took our interpreters and headed up to Ramadi, and we came to a farmhouse that had been, you looked at the building and it basically looked like cottage cheese. It had been completely destroyed by heavy military fire. And the story went something like this, according to the people involved, the families involved at the scene, and then with follow-up efforts to try to extract information from the military to get their side of the story. And basically what happened was a family was sitting down to break their fast. It was during Ramadan, and they were in the home, and it was men, women, children, and all of a sudden a large contingent of U.S. military showed up, Humvees, Bradleys, helicopters, ground troops, and surrounded the home and raided the home and took the family outside, put all the women and children over off to one side, and there were three men, and they laid them on the ground. They zip-tied their hands and laid them on the ground face down. I held them at gunpoint while they were searching the house, and the three men were executed by the soldiers that were standing over them, and then the house was basically completely destroyed. Blast holes through it, bullet holes all over. It was torched, and then a couple of days later, U.S. military personnel showed back up with a letter apologizing to the family that they had the wrong information on the house. Shortly after that, about 2 weeks later, in the aftermath of what happened after Saddam Hussein was captured, after the PKK found him and led the U.S. military to his hiding place, there were lots of demonstrations around the country. Some joyous, and some were pro-Saddam Hussein demonstrations. And I was in Baghdad, and on this one particular day, I had decided to go visit the Amariya bomb shelter, which is a bomb shelter, which many of you have probably heard of it. During the 91 U.S. attack on Iraq, was bombed. It was full of mostly 400 women and children, And I went in there to see what was left of the memorial after it had been looted in the aftermath of the fall of Baghdad. And I was, it was myself, a Hungarian videographer, and our interpreter, and we were coming, this is in the Amaria district of Baghdad, and we were coming back to go towards Baghdad, and we passed a secondary school that was completely sealed off by U.S. military, Humvees, Bradleys, M1 Abrams tanks, helicopters circling, troops all over the place, and a couple of big, kind of look like convoy trucks out in front. And the first couple of soldiers I tried to talk with wouldn't talk to me. Happens a lot. And then I finally found someone that would talk to me, which also happens a lot. And he said, well, basically what happened was there was some of the kids had a pro-Saddam demonstration in front of the school yesterday. They tore some of the Saddam Hussein photos out of their books and were doing it mainly because their teachers told them not to. Big shocker. And so the U.S. military was brutally cracking down on any kind of protests, pro-Saddam protests at this time across the whole country. And so they had Iraqi police show up and take photographs of the kids, and then they showed back up on this day with those photos. It sealed the entire school, went into the classrooms with the photos, with their guns, and detained 16 kids between the ages of 12 and 17 years old. And I watched them load them into these trucks and then start to drive away. And as they drove away and as they started to pull their military hardware out of the streets, kids were finally let out of the school, running past us screaming, completely hysteric, terrorized. Imagine if that was your kid, terrorized, and started to threaten me, because here's this white guy. And so we moved across the street and we're talking to some other students, getting information about what happened. And some of the kids started throwing rocks at some of the Bradley. A Bradley is a very heavily armored vehicle, by the way, as they were rolling across their treads down the streets away. And one of the soldiers on top started laying down suppression fire over our heads with his M16. It's basically a big crowd of kids. Granted, not shooting at the kids, but again, more terrorism. And I remember clearly, and I write about this in my book, because I remember very clearly one of the last bits of the scene was a Bradley was going away into the sun, and a young kid was on the side of the road with a rock, holding it, getting ready to throw it, and I remember clearly the soldier stood up on top of the Bradley and just pulled out his handgun and was just kept it trained on the kid's head as they went off into the distance. I want to talk briefly about infrastructure. I did a very detailed report about the water situation back in January 2004. It was published in Spring 2004, and I focused specifically on Bechtel, San Francisco-based Bechtel, which was awarded $680 million worth of no-bid contracts in the very early, actually before the invasion was even complete. I focused in on them because they had the initial contracts to repair the water infrastructure situation in Iraq, and I went down to one of the places listed that they were to do their work down in Najaf, south of Baghdad, and I spoke with the engineers at that water treatment plant and said, have you had any foreign contractors here doing any work or any subcontractors? And they basically said, Bechtel who? And as a result of this, when I went around, and even at this time, they said they were only able to supply about 45% of the city and surrounding villages with water. And I went to some of those villages, and one in particular, there was about 1 hour of electricity a day. This was in January 2004. It's worse now. And there was a big hole that they had dug through the ground and tapped into a pipe. And when that 1 hour would run, that hole would fill with water. And that was the main drinking water source for the village. So there were kidney stones, diarrhea, rampant nausea. 8 children from that village had been killed crossing the nearby highway to a factory across the street that would sometimes give them clean water. Today, fast forward to present tense, as we speak, hundreds and hundreds of cases of cholera are across Baghdad, the capital city, and southern Iraq. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people have died and are dying. 1.2 million Iraqis, according to two different studies, one in the U.S., one in the U.K., are now dead. almost 5 million are displaced from their homes, half in the country, half out of the country. And according to Oxfam International, 8 million Iraqis are in dire need of emergency assistance, meaning if they do not get access to safe drinking water, food, and medical attention when necessary, they're literally at risk for their lives. And so when we add that up, that's over 50% of the total population of Iraq that are either displaced from their homes, in need of emergency assistance, or dead. And that is what is being referred to as success by Barack Obama and John McCain, thanks to the surge. So I hope that you take the anger and the emotions that you feel listening to all of this testimony today from everybody and put it to good work. I don't think we should be afraid of being angry. I think if you're not enraged at hearing all of this information, then you're just not conscious. And I think that that anger should be used as a weapon to effect change immediately. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. I'm Bahar Bhatti. I'm a psychiatrist from Iraq. I left Iraq in 2006. If I were in Iraq now, I would have been a consultant psychiatrist, but now, and by mere chance and good luck, I'm now here as a part-time counselor. And I'm really privileged somehow because the Iraqi refugees who are arriving here, and they are all educated, most of them, they can get jobs as janitors, or the best of them will get a cashier. So anyway, what I want also to say is that here I am, I'm displaced, uprooted actually, waiting for my family to come. Still, they are not here. I lost my status, of course, in Iraq. I lost my clinic. And thanks heaven, I said that I'm safe, physically safe. My daughter also survived an explosion, car bomb. She's left just with scars. And she will be able to get here as soon as possible, I hope. What I want to say also is that in addition to being a psychiatrist, so that was not a direct danger to me, I was also a writer. So the last article I wrote, it was against one of the prominent politicians who has a very strong militia, and so my name appeared on a hit list, and I had to threaten to be assassinated. So I had to leave Iraq immediately at that time. And this is the way that most of the intellectuals and technocrats in Iraq are silenced. Either killed or forced to leave the country, or if they are unable to leave, they will be just suppressed. I'm also a member, or I was a member, founder member of the Iraqi Minorities Council. I represented the Christians. And actually I ran in the national elections that you heard about. I ran as a candidate in one of the lists, and I was a manager of one monitoring project of the elections. So I can also tell you that it wasn't really free national elections. Regarding the Christians, I think most of you have heard in the last 2 weeks, more than 1,000 family was deported, forcefully deported from Mosul City to the north. About 40 people were killed. The official number says 13, but the reports say it's 40 houses were bombed. And this is a kind of the crisis that we still have in Iraq. On the other hand, I founded an organization. It was called Al Jannah, which means paradise. Al Jannah for psychosocial humanitarian services. And I can tell it was only one of its kind. And after I left, there is no such organization. But there are the services there. The mental health services are very scarce. And when we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder in Iraqi population, we are not talking about individuals or a rate of individuals among a population. It is a mass PTSD, a post-traumatic stress disorder. The physical danger in Iraq, like when I leave my home, I don't know if I'm coming back or not, but we just live with a denial. So the danger is diverse, anonymous, and you can't predict it by time or place. So its severity and its chronicity has led to what I can call as a mass PTSD. and there is no way to provide any kind of services in Baghdad. If you want to go now, as I hear from Baghdad, Baghdad is divided into camps, divided by walls. If you want to reach a place, you need at least like 2 hours for a place which had been for 30 minutes in the past. So people, even if there are services, the people will not be able to reach them, and everybody is trying just to survive within the violence, the danger of the violence, and the lack of services that Daher has described. Yes, there is cholera, there is anthrax spreading in the north, and even in the most elitist parts of Baghdad, they don't have electricity for more than 2 hours. I'm speaking right now. No water for human consumption. So I can... And for the rate of the PTSD, after 5 years of war, last summer, I think there was a national survey, the numbers were not declared. This policy of not declaring the numbers was adopted by Saddam Hussein. He considered that as part of related to national security, so he wouldn't reveal them. And this same policy is still going on. The numbers are not declared. So I think I can cut it short by saying that in spite of all the sacrifices and sufferings of Iraqi and American people, there was no democracy in Iraq, and even worse, it's not even envisioned, because nobody has a plan, as Tahar said. No, there's no plan right now for Obama or for McCain. And what I would like to say finally is that a few people like to do some practical thing to help Iraqis. Maybe you can start by helping the Iraqi refugees who are arriving here. So I'll hope to see you soon again. Thank you.
I'm Zahir Wahab, and I teach at Lewis and Clark College. I have been going to Afghanistan since early 2002, spending about 4 to 5 months there in the early part of the year, every year, including this year. I was there from February to mid-June. I'd like to thank the sponsors and the organizers, but also you, for making Afghanistan as part of the conversation. Because it seems to me that Afghanistan is not just a victim of a savage invasion and occupation, but it also seems to be a casualty of a conspiracy of silence, perhaps complacency and complicity. So I appreciate being here and Afghanistan being addressed in these forums. My mother keeps telling me that I shouldn't go back. She lives in Afghanistan. Most of my family lives in Afghanistan, but something compels me to go and see if we can rebuild higher education system, but also for me to keep learning about the country and also sort of watching the new imperialism and the new colonialism in action. A lot of, I would just like to quickly outline just a few things what I've learned over the last 7 years. For those of you who are interested in some of this, a lot of this stuff is actually documented. There are studies and reports by various organizations. Many of you know them, but I'll be very happy to provide specific references if you need to. So, cumulatively, this is what I have learned over the last 7 years. First of all, tens of thousands of Afghans have been killed since October 2001. According to Mark Herold of the University of New Hampshire, this year alone, 3,200 civilians have been killed due to NATO and American bombardment. As you know, there's more bombing going on in Afghanistan now than in Iraq, because there are very few troops on the ground, so they have to rely on heavy air power. So far, 609 Americans have been killed. This year alone, 227 NATO and American troops have been killed. The United States alone spends about $100 million a day on the military operation in Afghanistan. There are some 40 other countries, as you know, having troops and fighting, so $100 million a day can do quite a bit of damage to the country, and it's doing so. Afghanistan has the largest number of widows, orphans, amputees, and I think I can say beggars. You see this everywhere. Thousands of people have been imprisoned in Bagram, Kandahar, Jalalabad, and we all know about Guantanamo. There's an excellent book by a woman, an Afghan-American lawyer, perhaps some of you have seen it. It's called My Guantanamo Diary. And many of you probably have seen Taxi to the Dark Side and or Lifting the Veil, special on women, and you can get an idea. Search and seizure goes on everywhere, in Kabul, throughout the country. And I should point out that I speak both of the national official languages, and I am unembedded when I am in Afghanistan, and I don't live in one of the green zones when I'm in Kabul. So I travel, I talk to people, I hear things, I read, so I know. Countless people are victims of extreme poverty. Remember, this is one of the poorest countries in the world to begin with, and then there has been these wars, sanctions, and occupations over the last 30 years, and you can see the impact, the level of poverty and sickness, degradation, homelessness, and so forth. Last winter, hundreds of people froze to death because they had no place. It got very, very cold. There was no place for them to be. Afghanistan has more than a million drug addicts, and the drugs, of course, are relevant and related to the occupation and invasion. There's no time to go into that, but were it not for the invasion and occupation, drugs would not be this kind of a problem. But at least a million addicts, and the country simply doesn't have the resources or the capacity to address this very serious problem. You see drug addicts everywhere in the city. Afghanistan is a major source and a destination and a transit point for human trafficking, especially women and young boys, for the usual reasons that you all understand. It's sort of a silent disaster. There's much physical, economic, and psychological violence committed against women and children. Women's suicide is one of the biggest problems in the country, in particular amongst younger women and people who have returned from abroad, because of the forced marriages, arranged marriages, but also sometimes families would simply sell their daughters, even a year-old daughter or younger daughter or older daughter, simply to feed themselves. And so many, many young women resort to suicide and suicide attempts. This is a country where not just individuals, but whole families live on $1 a day. Per capita income is $1 a day, and that means for a whole family. So a school teacher, a civil servant, or a police may be paid $2 a day, and you try to live on that in a very expensive time. Studies indicate that 70% of the Afghans have been traumatized because of the protracted wars and so forth. It has 2 million people who are seriously mentally ill. Right now, if you're in Afghanistan, I've seen the situation get worse steadily. So initially, in the first, and Dar was there, in 2002, 3, and 4, I could travel. I could go almost anywhere. But right now, it's very difficult to move. The UN has declared 60% of the country as no-go area, which is to say that the narco state, the broken state, the fragile state which the Americans installed, is unable to deliver health, education, employment, or any kind of work. In short, I think society is dying, but I think a better way to put it would be that a society is being murdered, and it's done on live television. Thank you.
You're listening to Portland Winter Soldier, held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Portland in October 2008. At 2:15, we will again take your phone calls at 503-231-8187. In the studio will be Palestinian journalist Saeed Banora, as well as Ned Roche and Maxine Folkson, the co-founders of the local branch of No More Victims, a group which brings Iraqi children injured by the U.S. occupation to the U.S. for medical treatment. First, we will hear the testimony of Ahmed Abed, the father of Mustafa Abed, who just returned to Fallujah, Iraq, after 3 months in Portland.
After the panel began, we just got word that we actually do have an additional Iraqi, fortunately, who has shown up and would like to speak. His name is Ahmed Abad.
طبعا أنا أشكر جميع الحضور اللي إجهم حتى يسمعون قصتي تفاصيلها.
I'm very happy to be here. I'm very thankful for you guys came here to listen to my story today.
أنا أحمد عبد من العراق من مدينة الفلوجة.
My name is Ahmed Abid. I'm from Iraq, from Al-Fallujah.
أنا أبدي قصتي ولو هي قصة حزينة طبعا بس يجب أن نحكيها كل صراحة.
So to start, it's a sad story, but I have to share it with you despite the pain and the suffering we have.
أنا والد الطفل مصطفى اللي طبعا مصطفى كان مريض قبل أن يصيب الحادث بيوم فأخذته للمستشفى لغرض علاجه كان عمره هو سنتين.
I'm a father of Mustafa. Mustafa, when he gets struck by American airplanes or American missiles, he was 2 years old.
فأخذته للدكتور الأخصائي مال الأطفال وانطاع علاج وما كان العلاج كله متوفر بالمستشفى.
Before the strike happens, he took his son to a doctor for a treatment, and the treatment was not found at the clinics.
طلب مني الدكتور أن باقي العلاج أخذه من الصيدليات الخارجية عندنا هناك.
So the doctor told him to go and look for medicine for his son somewhere else outside the clinic.
فطبعا أخذت المصطفى ورحنا نزلنا للسوق مال المدينة.
So I took Mustafa, I went to the market to look for medicine for my son.
فاشتريت لأني يعني بعض الحلويات.
I bought him some sweets and desserts.
واشتريت له طبعا شوز جديد.
I bought him a new shoes.
فرجعنا بعدين للبيت.
Then we return home.
فكان رمضان هناك بالعراق شهر ال 11 سنة 2004.
It was in November 2004 in the holy month of Ramadan.
فتقريبا الساعة السادسة.
It's around 6 o'clock in the evening.
اجت والدته شايلة مصطفى فقالت لي أبو مصطفى أنا راح أخذ مصطفى حتى أضربه نص من الأبرة لأن الدكتور قال يسوون الأبرة 3 مرات إلى لأن هو كان عمره سنتين.
His mom, she was going to get the immune shots for her son, so she decided to carry her son and go out to the clinic so he can get his immune shots.
قلت لها ماكو اي مشكله فقالت راح اخذ البنت خالتي اللي هي مضمده تشتغل.
So she said she will take Mustafa with her and with her sister, which is Mustafa's aunt, which is she was a nurse as well.
بيتهم كان هو واقع على اطراف مدينه الفلوجه.
So his aunt, Mustafa's aunt's house was close by Al-Fallujah, nearby.
فورا ما يعني راحت مصطفى اخذت مصطفى حتى تضرب الأبرة طبعا ورا تقريبا ربع ساعة مو اكثر فسمعنا صوت انفجار كلش قوي.
So 15 minutes after she left the home, they heard a big explosion.
فطبعا هناك الناس كلها رقضت حتى تشوف شنو السبب الانفجار هذا وشنو القصف هذا.
The people ran to see what caused this explosion and this shelling.
فأنا طبعا هم يعني حالي حال الناس اللي رقضت على مكان القصف حتى.
Of course I, like everybody else, ran like the rest of the people to see what was going on.
فوصلت المكان هذا اللي صار به القصف.
I reached the place where the shell struck.
إلا ويصادفني ولد نازع التيشيرت مالته وشايل مصطفى حضنه هيك يعني حامله.
On my way there I saw a boy who took his t-shirt off and was carrying Mustafa.
ومصطفى طبعا مبتوره رجله اليسرى ومصارينه كلها واقعه من بطنه طالعه.
Mustafa's left leg had been blown off. His intestines were falling out of his abdomen.
يعني كان مشهد يعني كلش مروع إلي من شفت أنا طفل بهاي الحالة.
I mean, this situation was horrifying for me to see my child in this condition.
فبعدين جابوا والدته شايلينها ببطانية أربع شباب كانت فاقدة الوعي مضروبة بإيدها ومضروبة بالصفحة مالتها.
And then they brought his mom. Four young men carrying her on a blanket. She was unconscious, wounded in her arm and was wounded in her forehead as well.
لأن هي كانت شايلة مصطفى. من رجعت بالطريق وقعت قذيفة صاروخ وقع يعني مسافة ما يقارب 12 متر عنهم.
Because she had been carrying Mustafa and on her way back from the pediatrician's office, a shell, a missile landed and detonated just 12 meters away from them.
كانت اكو عندنا سياره موجوده ونقلناهم المستشفى المدينه مال فلوجه.
We brought a car and took them to the hospital in Fallujah.
فلما اجوا الاطباء وشافوا مصطفى على الساديه ومصطفى رجله مبتوره ومصارينه كلها طالعه.
When the physicians came and saw Mustafa, his leg was gone and his intestines were out.
دخلوا للعمليات مصطفى.
They took him to surgery immediately.
وبقى ساعتين بالعمليات وبعدين استدعوا والدته هم دخلوها للعمليات فبقوا أربع ساعات بالعمليات.
He remained in surgery for 2 hours. Then they took his mother to surgery. The two of them were in surgery for a total of 4 hours.
فمن خرج الدكتور من صالة العمليات فسألت آني عن حالة مصطفى ووالدته.
When the doctor came out of the operating room, I asked him about Mustafa and his mother, my wife.
فهو يعني رد علي وقال لي أنتوا شفتوا حالة مصطفى من جبتوه هنا للمستشفى كانت رجله مبتورة ومصارينا طالعة.
The doctor said, well, you saw Mustafa's condition when he came in. His leg was gone and his intestines were out.
قال لي مصطفى ما اقدر انطيك به ضمان ولو يعني 10 دقائق لان حالته هو صعبه كلش.
He told me that he could not guarantee that he would live for even 10 minutes because his condition was very serious.
والدته لا قال لي والدته احسن منه اصابته شويه.
And told me that Mustafa's mother was in a slightly better situation. Her wounds were not critical.
Yeah, أنا طبعا أب مؤمن بالقدر اللي صار لابني.
I am a father who believes in fate about what happened to my son.
بس يبغى يعني قلبي على ابني يعني أتألم من أشوف أطفال يلعبون وهو ما يقدر يلعب وياهم.
But my heart aches for my son. It hurts me to see children playing while he cannot play with them.
طبعا وراجعت أنا الحكومة الأمريكية بالعراق والحكومة العراقية وما أكو أي فائدة. ابني كانت حالته كلش صعبة فالدكتور الأخصائي اللي كان يعالجه بالعراق.
Of course I contacted the US administration in Iraq and the Iraqi government but to no avail. The condition of my son was very bad.
فقال لي يعني ابنك صعب أن يتعالجه بالعراق
لأن إذا ما يطلع خارج العراق يعني ابنك صعب أن يتعالج بالعراق.
The specialist who treated him in Iraq told me that it was very difficult to treat my son in Iraq. He said that he should go outside of Iraq to seek treatment because it would be very difficult to find the needed medical care inside Iraq.
فأنا طبعا أشكر منظمة نومر فيكتيمز اللي مدت يد العون إلي والعائلتي والطفلي.
I, of course, thank the No More Victims organization for extending a helping hand for me, my family, and my child.
وجابوه هنا لأمريكا وديت عالد وصحته يعني كل زين يعني.
For bringing him here to America for treatment. And now his health is much better.
وصحيح يعني أنا فرحان أن ابني تعالج بس هم حزين بنفس الوقت لأن أكو آلاف الأطفال بالعراق هم مثل حالة ابني وأسوأ.
I'm happy that my son's feeling much better and he find the treatment here. But you know, still you know he's sad about other kids in Iraq. Their situation is really never have a chance to come here.
وآلاف الأطفال الأيتام هم بالعراق بسبب الاحتلال.
Thousands of kids they are orphans. Because of occupation in Iraq.
وأنا أشكركم شكرا جزيلا على لقائي بكم وأنا فرحان طبعا سمعت قصتي.
I'm so happy to be here today and thank you very much for listening to my story and being here today for me.